one.
Yeah, I had it kind of rough last Saturday.
It's Ralph Anderson interviewing Zeeler Turner on March 22nd, 1984. Zeeler, one of our meetings, one of our sessions, you mentioned that Chattanooga community, the black community in particular, had the east and the west and a number of different areas that was broken up into, and that there really wasn't a lot of contact between people in those different parts of the community. They were separate neighborhoods.
That's
wondering if you could describe those.
That is correct. As far as east side was concerned, it started on the east side of Market Street. Market Street was a division line between the east and the west of Chattanooga. On the east side, usually starting at the foot of the present Bardock along 3rd Street. That was the beginning of what was known as Bushtown.
Bushtown?
That's right.
And that was a black neighborhood?
That is correct. All that area from, well, the City Code, well, that was near the river, all the way to McCullough Avenue. And as far east as the Ridge, East Ridge.
Hmm.
And all of those areas in there were occupied by most of the people who lived in that area on their own homes. Some of them had small homes, some of them had larger homes, but it was that kind of community.
This is Bushtown.
That's Bushtown. Now, farther to the east, from Willow Street and over to McCullough Avenue, that area was known as Rosstown. Then from East 3rd Street back to City Cove, that was known as Churchville. Bushtown was named for a man named Bush, as even Rosstown was named for a man named Ross. As far as Churchville was concerned, it had the right name, in that there was a church on every corner, even in the middle of the streets there were churches. Some were small, some were large, but that's where it got its name from, was the fact that there were so many little churches in that area, so they nicknamed it Churchville. Now from the other side of Market Street, let's see, as far as, I guess, near the mountains, in this area was known as the West Side. Then you had an area known as the South Side. Now, the North Side was never mentioned because they were the only three sections that were inhabited by blacks at that time. And the children, or even sometimes the grown-ups, that lived on the east side of town only mingled with those who lived on that side of town. Unless they had maybe members of the family might marry someone who lived, say, on the west side or the south side, and they would visit them in that way. But as a rule, they stayed within their own boundaries. It was almost as though it was kind of like a town. It was separated in three parts, east side, west side, and south side. When I started, I had finished school. I finished grammar school at Old Orchard Knob.
That would have been in what part of town?
That would have been on the east side.
Bushtown?
That's right. That was Bushtown. Then, when I finished the fourth grade at Old Orchard Knob, then I went to a school known as Lincoln High School. At one time, the year before I went there, they changed it from Lincoln High School to Lincoln Junior High. And before, when it was a Lincoln High School, all of the children who lived, all the black children in this area, both east, west, north, and south. They went to school at Lincoln because it carried 12 grades. And there was no other high school in the county until they built Howard High School on 9th and Carr.
So regardless of which of the communities you lived in,
you had to go to Lincoln. But then when they built Howard on 9th and Carr, then as I say, Lincoln became Lincoln Junior High. So that gave those who lived in South Chattanooga and on the west side, they went to school at Howard. And that's how, and even had children from the Ridge, they had to go to Howard High School. And that's how I met a lot of people that I had never known before.
Once you were through school, most people went to their own community.
That's right.
How were these communities different? Were there any differences between them?
Not really.
All of them, people own their own houses?
Yes, most of them own their own homes.
Did the poor blacks live in a particular area? Did the poor blacks live?
Yeah, they did. There were certain areas where they lived. Now, most of the main streets, like East 3rd Street, you had a class of blacks who had nice homes. Then on the side streets, you had what we used to call gunshot houses, which consist of three rooms right from went in the front door and right straight out the back door.
Gunshot?
That's what they call them gunshot houses.
So why do they call them that?
Because they were went straight through.
Oh, I see.
That was where they got the name from, gunshot. Of course, now, most of the people who lived in those houses were people who had dignity, they had respect, but their incomes were small. And some of them had to work as domestics, although you still had some blacks who had nice homes who also were domestics. Now they were the people who worked for those persons on Lookout Mountain, on the Ridge, and in Signal Mountain. And of course, according to your income is where you lived. And as I say again too, you had the railroad was here at that time. So you, and by it, by Chattanooga being the crossroad of the United States, you had young black men who worked for the railroad as dining car waiters. Some of them worked as red caps. But they had a good income, and that was a sure income.
Did the people who worked for the railroad live in a particular area of town?
Not necessarily. They lived all over.
Uh-huh.
You didn't have railroad people living in one area and maybe people who worked for people on the mountain in another area. In other words, any place that the person could buy the land that they wanted, that's where they moved.
Is there an area where wealthy black people live? People who have quite a bit of money?
Well, let me say this. You had a cross section of people. You might have a wealthy black living on this cone, and in between you may have a man work for the railroad, one work for somebody on Lookout Mountain. That was the way it was. It was all intermingled. Your neighbor could be richer, the neighbor could be poor, but everybody got to live together. That was the main thing. Not legally, but we just good friends, and I think a lot of them. She's a young girl, and she thinks a lot of me. She made me feel real proud the other day when she told me, she said, my mother died, and I I was very close to her, and she said, I like you a lot, so I'm going to call you my mother.
That's nice. That's a good
feeling. Well, anyway, as I say, people were kind of intermingled together. And nobody looked down on anyone else because of what they had.
But along the main streets, like East 3rd Street,
mm-hmm. You had a mixture, let me put it that way. You had a mixture of different kind of people.
Like the main streets?
In the other section of town, as I say, they were all intermingled together. You didn't have one section for the poor, and one section for the rich, or one section for the in-between. Everybody was everybody's neighbor. That was the way it was.
Where were most of the black businesses located in the 30s, 40s?
Most of the businesses were located on what is now MLK Boulevard, is known as 9th Street. And it ran from West 9th over here on the west side of Market Street, all the way through East 3rd Street, out in the east. You had, you would have in some sections of the town, like I mentioned about the man who had the laundry. Now he didn't live too far from where I lived on East 3rd Street, but this was on Hawthorne, across street. And then you might find, farther up the street, you found two grocery stores run by blacks. You found a repair shop for shoes. Then you might find a seamstress. It was just different anywhere that a person, in other words, the location of a business was where it served the most people. Uh-huh. If it was a neighborhood where there were a lot of people, then you might find some kind of business set up in that particular area. But the main flux of business was on East 9th Street.
And all these communities, they had everything that the black community needed, like automobile repair shops and
You had those. Of course, now during that time, back in the early 30s, would you believe there weren't too many black people that owned cars?
Is that right?
No.
You said your dad didn't own a car until...
Until it was in the early 40s when he bought a car. But as I say, you didn't have that many blacks with cars, because you had the streetcar, which was convenient to most people, and they didn't see the need of a car. And now you had some of the blacks who were, what you might say, had money. They might have a car, but there was no such thing as two-car garage among blacks. One car served the whole family. Now, the people that had cars were those who were in the, who were morticians. They had cars. Now, there was a Mr. J.F. Trimble, I believe was his initials. He was a black mortician. And in 1929, the Hardwicks came here from Cleveland, Tennessee. The Hardwick, C.H. Hardwick, came here from Cleveland, Tennessee. And he put up a building, which is still standing, there on the corner of 9th and Palmetto. And he brought with him his two sons. And the oldest boy was about, I guess he was about 19 or 20.
Yeah, these are the morticians.
These
are the morticians.
Uh-huh.
Right.
The oldest boy was in business with his father. The other boy was in school, in high school. And later he went to Fisk University in Nashville. But he was not directly associated with the business until in later years. Then there was Ben Franklin was a mortician.
Ben Franklin?
That's right, Ben Franklin. Johnny Franklin's brother. You know Johnny Franklin, the commissioner, vice mayor?
Oh.
His brother was was a mortician.
And those are good professions.
That's right. And then you had, then there was another one. I've forgotten his name, but anyway, later years, over here on the west side, there was Buck Hannon's funeral home. Mr. Buck Hannon had been a railroad man, and it was only after he retired from the railroad that his wife opened up the funeral home. And she went in with a fellow named, his name was Otis, but I can't remember what his last name was right now. Cox was his name. His name was Otis Cox. Now, Otis was an embalmer, and he had worked for Trimble, and I think he had worked, I know he worked for Buchanan, and he also, I think, worked for Franklin at one time. But at one time, you had about 6 black morticians in this town.
Where, was there a segregated cemetery in those days?
Yes, very much so.
Where was it
at? One at Pleasant Hill, one at Holland Park, which is out east. Now, I don't remember where Pleasant Hill is because I have a sister buried there, and it was acquired in later years, so I don't know too much about it, but I do know about Holland. It's even owned by blacks. Uh-huh.
So morticians were businessmen.
That is correct. That's
what
right.
What were some other types of black businesses in
that state? Oh yes. There were 2 hospitals, black hospitals here at one time.
2 black hospitals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one on the corner of 8th and Douglas Street. That was known as a Wheeler Hospital. It was owned and operated by a Dr. Emma Wheeler.
A black physician?
Black physician, a woman.
A woman?
That's right. And her husband was also a doctor. In fact, he was our family doctor, and he brought me into the world. Mm-hmm. Now, she, not only did she have the hospital, but she also had on the top floor an area where she had nurses, girls who wanted to be nurses in residence.
Student nurses?
That's right, and she taught them the nursing trade. Now, in later years, it must have been sometime between 38 and 40-something, there was a hospital over here on the west side known as Carver's Hospital. And it was black.
Owned and run by black?
That's right.
Black physicians practice?
That's right.
Were black physicians?
And black nurses. Oh, in fact, let me see. At one time, there must have been at least 10 or 12 black physicians. There were at least, that I know of, 4 black dentists. There were 2 pharmacists that ran their own drugstores. One was out east in Churchville, The other one was on East 9th Street, about where, I believe it's where, the post office is, somewhere in that area.
Is that in Georgetown?
No, that's here in town.
Oh.
That's in the city.
Oh.
It used to be called the East Side Grill. That was the name of the drugstore. And it was owned by black pharmacists.
So there were black physicians, black dentists, pharmacists?
Yeah, black surgeons.
Were there offices mostly on East 9th Street, do you think?
No, they had them in different places now. Dr. M. Wheeler and Dr. J. N. Wheeler had their offices on 8th Street. Some of the others, now there were several buildings on East 9th Street where the dentists, now upstairs over the East Side Grill, there were there's more than four dentists, because there was a Dr. Field, a Dr. Young, and a Dr. Smith in that one building. And then there was another doctor, I don't remember his name. And then there was a Dr. Bynes, he also was a dentist. In other words, there must have been at least five or six black dentists here in this town.
You think most of the blacks in Chattanooga went to the black doctors and dentists?
Yes, they did. They patronized them. They really did. Else they'd have never been able to stay in business. But they did. They patronized them. And I guess the first time I ever saw a white doctor to be attended by was when I went to North Carolina. And I was a good grown woman at that time. But as I say, they were very well able to take care of the patients that they had. And in fact, to tell you the truth about it, since I have been home this time, it seems that there were more people then than there is now, unless public housing has taken those people. Now, I know offhand that there must be in this 12 project sites, including the high-rises, and then with the scatter sites, about 16 places owned by CHA. And there must be some 15,000 people living in public housing. So I imagine when you take these people out of a community, like they had in the East and the South and the West, and group them all together, because see, there were no high rises, no public housing when I was growing up. And
people live in neighborhoods.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it just seemed that people have just been put together like a colony instead of being spread out over an area. They're all combined into one small place.
Do you think those neighborhoods still exist pretty much like they did there? Do you think they're
I have found out the hard way. CHA, as an urban development agency for the government, is cleaning out the communities. People that used to live, say, well, just say for instance, you had a block of houses next to each other. They've torn those houses down and there's nothing there.
Just empty.
Just empty spots. People that live in, some of the people who are trying to maintain their home, they lose them too.
Well,
because most of them on fixed incomes. Their utility bills are high and they can hardly live. But they're still trying to maintain a home.
Neighborhoods that have been there for 50 or 60 years.
Been longer than that. Yeah, some of them. Now, the house where I was born, my parents were there at least 12 or 15 years before I was born. And I am 71, I'll soon be 71 years old, so you see how old that building is.
So some of those neighborhoods that you were talking about may have been in place for 100 years.
That's right. That's exactly right.
What about this business at Cameron Hill? That used to be a black neighborhood.
It did.
What happened when they chopped that off?
Well, I tell you what I have been told, because I wasn't here at the time, but from what I have been told, over here on this west side, you had, and I repeat the word, gunshot.
Gunshot houses.
That's right. In other words, I don't remember who the mayor was at that time, but I think it was a man named Old Jolly.
Oh, the one that Bridges named
after. That's right. Anyway, at that time, this was after I left home. This was at the end of the 30s. There, they started public housing around about that time in other places. They were trying to move out the blight to a city, such as having these gunshot houses and trying to change the city and make it, in other words, they call it a better place to live.
Mm-hmm.
You had rats and roaches, and they caused a nuisance in the town.
This is early 40s, late 30s?
In the latter part of the 30s.
Okay.
So the mayor decided that he would get with the city planner, come up with some idea of what they could do to make Chattanooga a better place to live, give the people better housing and a safe and healthy place to live, to get rid of all these little bitty houses that seem to be crammed in a small area. So they began to tear down these little houses.
The gunshot houses.
That's right.
Tear down whole blocks.
That's right. And of course, in order to make room for the things, they had to come to Cameron Hill. Just like they've gone to other places. They have graded down Cameron Hill. It's not high like it used to be. So they decided to put up buildings that would look well, to landscape them so that they would look beautiful. So they began to weed out the people that lived in the little gunshot houses. In some of those little gunshot houses, there had been three generations of families.
Where'd those people go?
Some of them went into public housing, some of them died. They had to go wherever they could go, and of course, there used to be what is known as the old folks' home. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of old folks.
All right, there used to be a place out on East 3rd Street where men and women who were too old to work and who had no means of an income to take care of.
You call it the poorhouse family?
That's right. It's called an old folks' home. And some of these people didn't want to go there.
It wasn't a nursing home?
No nursing home. No, they didn't even know what that meant. Nursing home was only coming to being here recently. No, they didn't have a nursing home. So some of the people dreaded to go because if they were a part of a large family, maybe the son or daughter with whom they were staying with not able to take care of them. They had to work. Maybe the person needed attention. And they couldn't afford to hire somebody to take care of them. So they had to put them in old folks' home. Well, if I'm not mistaken, it was at that time that the government came up with a pension plan called Old Folks Pension. It was very little. It was somewhere in the neighborhood about $11 per month. Of course, it gave those persons who lived in the old folks' home, if it was under an administration that cared about the people, they might be given maybe 50 cents, a quarter, to spend any way they wanted to, but the rest of it went towards their room and board and upkeep.
Blacks and whites both in this?
Yes, they had one part of it for whites and one for blacks. No, they didn't put them together, No, they were separated, they were segregated.
In the same building.
That's right, that's exactly right. No, there was no integration. No, none. And there was even segregation if some of the people went to the a white doctor. It was segregated in the hospitals, except in the black hospital. If you had to go to Erlanger, they had a place for blacks to go and a place for the whites to go. And a lot of times, the nurse, who would be white, if she sized you up and decided she didn't want you to see that doctor, even though you may have had an appointment, she would call a white patient in before she called a black man.
You'd just sit there.
You'd sit right there. And if you were sick, and maybe perhaps, now there were some doctors who were specialized in different fields, the black doctors. But now, if you had an ailment that they had not specialized in, then you had to go to a white doctor.
Did black doctors practice at Erlanger and the white hospitals too?
No. Only time a black doctor was called into a white hospital was if he had a black patient there. That was the only reason why he went. That's the only reason.
And there were black patients in the white hospitals.
That's right. Yeah, they, in fact, Erlanger used to be called a butcher pen. Because if you went there, you might not come out.
What was it called?
The butcher pen.
Oh, boy. Well, not a nice name for a hospital.
And I've only learned since I returned home in 75 that the hospital was named for the Empress Erlanger.
Baroness Erlanger.
And on one letterhead that I received from him and my husband, it says Empress Erlanger.
Oh, does it? Oh,
uh-huh. Yeah, it said Empress Erlanger. And I was kind of confused because Baroness Erlanger was supposed to be German. And isn't the Baron what comes under the German name, isn't that what that?
There were Russians called that.
Well, anyway, I was surprised when I got, it might have been a misprint, but I was surprised that it did have the Empress Erlanger on it. And that was the first time that I had ever known that it was named for her. But somehow it seems that in those years when I was born and up through the 30s, it seems that if a young white man wanted to become a doctor, they did not use animals to experiment with. They used humans. And the way they used them if someone, they watched the papers very carefully. And it didn't make any difference to them whether you were white or black. All they wanted was a body. And they would check the papers thoroughly to see who was buried when and at what time. Now, there was never an account of what they died of. They just died, and he was put in an obituary column. So that night, they would go and rob the grave of that body.
If there was no student doctors.
That's right. Because they had to have some way of finding out all the things. They didn't know that they could use guinea pigs and rabbits and monkeys and rats. They didn't know that the human body was somewhat in accord with those animals.
That was going on here in Chattanooga?
Yes, sir. And I would like to relate an incident that really happened, if I may.
I'd love to hear it. You know I'd love to hear it.
Out near Warner Park, that used to also be an era where you had some blacks that lived there. And this particular couple, they were black. They were both up in years, well, what we would call up in years then, but now it was somewhere around my 60 years of age, and that's young this day and time. Anyway, the man had been ill, but just a short time. So it used to be that sometimes people were embalmed and sometimes they weren't.
You weren't always.
They weren't always, because at that time it was not compulsory that a body be embalmed before being buried. Anyway, this man died. They did not embalm him. And they put him in the ground, not too far from where they lived. Anyway,
in the cemetery,
not too far. I don't know the name of the cemetery, but it wasn't too far from where he lived. Anyway, they did not have electricity in that area of town. People burnt lamps. And when I lived on East 3rd Street, there was a long time before we had electricity. We used lamps. Anyway, that night, his wife was sitting in the house reading by lamplight. And it was sometimes after midnight that these young student doctors
from Maryland,
I don't know, that was only a big hospital here then for anybody. It was the hospital. Anyway, they went, they dug open the grave, and when they opened the casket, well, it wasn't called a casket, called a coffin then. And when they opened it, the air got to the man, he came to it, got a bottle. Of course, he was in a stupor. He was, I guess, evidently he had been in a coma. And from the time that he had gone into that coma to the time they opened the casket, he'd come too.
But he had only
been in there a few hours because it was in the afternoon when he was buried. So we'll say give or take maybe 6 or 7 hours. And of course, coffins weren't like the casket you have because they were not sealed up close. They were made of wooden boxes, I mean made of wood. And of course they were porous and there was some air that could get to them.
Yeah.
Anyway, he realized that he was buried, had been buried, and he saw the opening and he crawled out of it, and of course the student doctor went one way and he went in opposite direction. So while he was stumbling around trying to get himself together, because I guess he was in kind of a stupor. So he finally realized that he better go home. So he found his way home, and when he got to the house, he knocked on the door.
Oh.
Because most people used to put a crossbar across their doors inside, and you had to knock to get in.
Crossbars?
Yeah, crossbars, you know, on, drop, I guess you call them crossbars.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Anyway, she said, "Who is it?" And he said, "Honey, open the door." And she was so stunned, she couldn't believe it. So she went and got the lamp, went back to the door, and she asked again who it was. And he says, "Me, honey." So she lifted up the latch with one hand and held a lamp in the other one. And when she saw him standing there with his barrel clothes on, she threw the lamp at him. But would you believe he lived 10 years after that?
10 years more.
I never will forget that as long as I live. I don't remember the name, but that was true. That wasn't no fiction. That's for real.
That's a good story. Can you believe it?
Oh, dear.
Those poor boys, they didn't get themselves a dead person.
No, they didn't get that one. But that was the only way they had of experimenting was. And then I tell you another way that they managed to get bodies to work on, I mean to experiment on. A lot of people say they didn't have families, especially men. You hardly ever found a woman walking the streets without anything. It was mostly the men. Maybe they were drunkards, dope fiends, or we had dope fiends even then. We call them dope fiends, but they used dope then. But not as many. But
was
you
it
had
older people then?
They were all ages.
All
it didn't
ages.
Make any difference. Because my father married a woman that had a daughter that was a dope fiend, and she was just in her early 30s. But anyway, they would walk the streets. These young students would walk, student life walk the streets. And maybe perhaps it, they'd see one of these people. Later, they'd go to the morgue at the funeral, you know, at the funeral home. And maybe perhaps there wouldn't be any money to bury that person. So for a few dollars, they'd pay the mortician to get rid of the body, let them have it. And they would use them for experiments.
Nobody worried much about it.
No, nobody. See, somebody like that, nobody would miss. They might miss them off the streets, but as far as having family and things, most of them didn't have anyone to care enough about. And rather than have the city or the county to bear them, it was much easier to sell the body to the student doctors.
You had quite a few drunkards and dope fiends?
Oh yes, you had just as many then. And I can remember when the ambulance, as I say, that's why it's kind of confusing for me in a way to understand. Because I can remember when all the morticians in this town that had an ambulance, they ran so frequently that you could almost time a watch by.
Morticians used to provide an ambulance.
They provide an ambulance service, yes.
Where'd the drunkards hang out in those days?
They hung out mostly on East 9th and West 9th Street. That's where you found the majority of them.
Taverns there?
I wouldn't call them taverns. Let's call them small places where somebody might sell cigarettes and candy and chewing gum, maybe cold drinks. Or else they would have an eating place, a cafe. And now there was one time when there was a man that had a place down on on East 9th Street that was separated into two parts. On one side he had for white, and on the other side he had for black. course, it was nice. It was nice, kept nice and clean. And this you won't believe. Do you know that at one time, chili was the thing that was sold most in this town?
Chili?
And that most people ate? Yes. Yes. You had places where they sold nothing but chili and cold drinks. And the people who made this chili never told what they used. You only knew that there was certain taste. And the chili was composed of pinto beans, franks or hot dogs or wieners, whichever one you want to call it, and chili powder. But then the trick was that some of them used certain spices and herbs that they didn't tell nobody what it was, and that made the taste. And they used to sell it, well, just say for instance, if you didn't go to the place to eat a bowl of chili, they had little cartons like ice cream used to come in. And you could buy any amount you wanted from 10 cents on. Now in a large, say like a quart carton would cost maybe about a quarter. A pint would be about 10 cents. And they sold them with what was known as oyster crackers.
Oh, I know what they are.
Yes, that's what they served it with. And a lot of people during that time, which was around, during the beginning of the Depression, which started back in the early 30s, a lot of people did not have the money to buy a complete meal. So if they had a dime, they could go to these places. And they were next door to each other. You go in this door and you get chili, go in the next door and you get chili. And that was the way it was. Everybody almost got rich just selling chili. And for a dime, you could go in and you could get a big bowl of chili. And they did not limit the number of oyster crackers you could have. You could have as many as you wanted. And some of them sat there and they made a meal. Because a lot of them, that was the only meal that they had. And they drank a glass of water and they were filled up. And they would not need anything else till the next day. And that's the way they lived. But it really was a big selling thing. Everybody loved that chili. And then some places that were cafes, they would sell stew meat. But then a lot of times the people buy the stew meat and then ask for a side bowl of chili. But that was the way the people survived. And would you believe that there were people, I wouldn't say they got rich, but a lot of them paid for their homes like that.
Selling chili.
Selling chili, yes sir. Now there used to be a place out on East 3rd Street at Holland Park that a fella named Paul Tatum used to have. Now he sold hot dogs and hamburgers, but he also sold chili. And he kept that place open almost 24 hours a day.
Oh.
Yes.
Keep people coming off from work.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Were there any real fancy restaurants in the black community in those days?
Not really. Because most everybody ate at home. Now, as I say, the cafes that were on East 9th Street, they really catered to people who had very little money to spend. Now, sometimes, maybe perhaps a person would have, maybe 25 or 50 cents. And they could go to these places and maybe get a complete meal. like they could have maybe bread of some sort, either biscuits or cornbread. They could have a serving of some kind of vegetables like turnip greens or green beans. And if it was in the summertime, they could have squash. And then they could have another vegetable of some sort. And maybe stew meat or a piece of chicken. And that would be all that they would need. And I doubt if it ever went over 50 cents.